Welcome to the Education Marketing Leader Podcast with Chris Raposo. If you're looking to dive into the latest industry insights, draw inspiration from education success stories, or just want to sharpen your marketing skills, you're in the right place. Here, we bring you a diverse range of voices from experts and leaders in the field, offering you a unique blend of professional development and practical strategies. Whether you want to understand your audience better, stay updated with the latest tech trends in marketing, or expand your professional network, we've got you covered. So while you're driving on your morning commute or winding down after a busy day, let's explore the dynamic world of education marketing together.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Education Marketing Leader with Chris Raposo. Today, my guest is no stranger to the higher ed community. You should know her. She is the founder and president of Solve Higher Ed Marketing, podcast host of Confessions of a Higher Ed CMO, and the new author of Heart Over Hype. Jamie Hunt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Welcome back. It's the third time Jamie's been on this show. I told her in a pre-interview, and we talked about it a little bit. Nobody has ever been on the show as often as she has. It seems like we have got a tradition every year in the in the beginning of the year. We got her on because she has something new coming up. First, we talked about the enrollment cliff. Last year, we talked about the new initiative with her agency. And now we're talking about her new book. And we're talking about the insights of Heart Over Hype with Jamie Hunt. So a little bit of background. You know, I heard a lot of hype on LinkedIn on my feed about the book. How does that support from the higher community makes your heart feel?
It feels so good. Like, it is so rewarding to see people excited about the book. When you pour your entire heart and soul into something, and then you put it out in the world and it's like, is anybody going to even notice? Does anybody even care? It feels so good when you put in all that effort to get people excited about what you've been excited about for months or years even.
Absolutely. Now let's start with the big picture here. You know, Heart Over Hype, such a powerful title. What inspired you to write this book, and why do you hope higher ed marketers take away from it?
Yeah, so I was having a conversation with a former colleague of mine, and she was saying that she felt like the leadership at her institution didn't understand empathy, and that they were not making decisions about how they market and how they lead based on empathy. And I had all these notes. I probably had about 12,000 words written in a book, but no like frame to put around it. And that conversation with her made me go, okay, I need to make this hook be about empathy. And then another conversation with a friend of mine was Amber Kennedy, I mentioned her in the book. She was like, one of the things I love about you is that you are your authentic self and you bring empathy into your leadership. And I was like, okay, so these two things sort of came together to create the two parts of this book. The first part is empathy in marketing, and the second part of the book is empathy in leadership. And that just, once I had those two conversations come together, it was like, okay, I have a hook for these 12,000 words. Now I just need to write about 40,000 more.
At the beginning of the book, you mentioned that the most important thing we can ever do is make the audience feel seen. And talking about empathy, something that jumped off the page for me when you defined empathy so vividly in a book, and I'm going to read it off here. The difference between watching a storm from a distance and stepping out into the rain and feeling it on your skin. And I was like, it's kind of like a mic drop moment for me where I thought, if I put the book down now and never read it again, if I take that key takeaway from that particular chapter, right, I know what I'm doing and I'm going to make a difference in my marketing. But why is this kind of emotional understanding so essential in higher ed marketing today? And how can we bring that level of empathy into our daily work?
Yeah, I think when we market, a lot of times we are doing it from a place of fear, a fear that we're not going to make our class, a fear that the enrollment cliff is going to hit us harder than we're prepared. You know, so much fear that we do all the things, you know, I'm putting that in air quotes, we do all these things that are designed for us. And we're not thinking about the experiences that our end users are having. So for example, if we're recruiting to non-traditional students and we're panicked, right? And so we're hitting them really hard in August, we're not thinking about the fact that for many people, August is a chaotic time of the year, getting ready for school, getting all the new clothes for your kids, the school supplies for your kids. That's the last time that you're thinking about going to college. And we're just adding to that noise and to that stress. Whereas, you know, if you're looking at the non-traditional students, again, you're looking at January, you've come off the high of the winter break, the holidays, the winter is dark and dreary, and you get into that season of being like, I need a change in my life. And at that point, I feel like it's like, that's the perfect time to hit somebody with a message about enrolling in college and making a change. But too often we're building our cycles around our timelines. We're building our cycles around what we want and what we need, and we're not thinking about the end users. And I really believe that if we think about what somebody is experiencing, thinking, feeling, and doing in any given moment, we're going to have a message that's more resonant for them. And that resonance will lead to us feeling more authentic, us feeling like we get them, us feeling like we see them. And that makes them more likely to enroll in our schools because they have this more personal connection versus just these transactional emails or these salesy emails. Even going so far as to say, we know you're getting a ton of messages right now. We don't want to bother you or whatever, but this is an important message, or acknowledging that this time of year is stressful for students as they're trying to figure out where they want to go. You know, those little tiny touches of humanity will rise above those generic messages that everybody else is sending out.
And with those kind of messages, you stand out from the crowd, and you build that trust. And once you build that trust, that they'll take the 5 seconds or 20 seconds, whatever long it takes, to look at that message, or even file it away to go back to it later, instead of just, you know, we all get bombarded with tons of marketing and sales messages, and if I just read the first two words of a subject line, I'm gonna delete it if it's not relevant, or if it, you know, takes me away from what I need to do right now. So definitely super important to hit them at the season where they're at and know where they're at in their personal life when it comes to adult learners and the busyness of life and the competing priorities, and knowing that if you put school on top of that, that's just another thing that's going to take them away from their family.
Yeah.
But early on, you're also right, we're being conditioned to believe that results are all that matter. And it's not just in the higher ed, it's in B2B, it's everywhere really, right? Because the ROI, especially with the economy, is top of mind there. So you've been in higher education marketing for over a decade on the CMO level. How has that mind shift changed over the recent years? You know, what's the cost of that kind of thinking, just to be like looking at the KPI, looking at the bottom line?
Yeah, I think there's huge risk there. Mm-hmm. I have talked to people who are being driven by their leadership to hit their numbers no matter what. And I 100% get that. We need to pay people. Mm-hmm. We need to pay the bills. But sometimes that means we're letting in students that aren't a good fit for our institution, whether they're not academically a good fit, or we're just, maybe it's a small school and this student would thrive at a big school, or the student's going to get lost at a big school. They should really be at a small school. And when we're really focused just on hitting that bottom line number, what ends up starting to falter is our retention rate. Mm. So we let in students that aren't a good fit. And I'm going to lean heavily on like the academic profile of the students. Let's talk about students who aren't a good academic fit. We let them in. They aren't successful. They drop out, or they fail out, or they leave and transfer somewhere else with a pile of debt. Our retention numbers go down, our graduation numbers go down, our reputation takes a hit. That's a very, you know, it takes a couple of years to get to a point of that having a really negative impact on your institution, but it will happen. It's guaranteed to happen if you just keep aiming for that bottom line. And instead, I think if we focus on finding the students that are right for us and making the case about why we are here to help them achieve what they want, right? It's not about us, it's about them. We're here to help them achieve their dreams. We care about what their dreams are. We're gonna help them get there. And this is why we're the right fit for that. I think the right students will flock to us, and we'll still meet that bottom line, but we're not doing it in ways like, let's just let in anybody. Let's really push this to students that aren't going to be successful here, aren't going to thrive here. So refocusing that, I think, is really important.
Very, very difficult for a junior level employee when they have that KPI and they see that one butt in the seat to let them go, right?
Yeah. Because
then all of a sudden they're like, the mindset may be, and this is also, you talk a lot about busting the silos, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in a siloed environment, all you worry about is your KPI and hitting that. And after that, it's like, it's out of my hands. I did what I had to do just to making that shift in mindset, to bringing everybody on the same page, of working towards the same goal, that the person who's in charge of bringing the student in should be also part of helping retain them throughout to graduation, and then helping the advancement team even with their continuous efforts there, because it's not just the 4 years or whatever they're on your school. They influence other prospective students, whether it's their own kids, whether it's their neighbor's kids, to come to your school, and the reputation can be tarnished if they're leaving that institution with a bitter taste in their mouth. And word travels fast in communities, right?
Yes. I don't want to say which institution, but I talked to an institution that at one point had close to 800 students enrolled in a program, and they stopped delivering high quality service. So when they started, they were like a very concierge type service to that program. And the students told their friends about it and the program grew to almost 800 students. And then they kind of took their foot off the gas on that concierge service. They stopped being as helpful. They stopped, being as engaged in student success. And when they talked to me, they had dropped to fewer than 300 students in the program. And it just took a matter of a couple years. Bad word of mouth is worse than good word of mouth is good, if that makes sense. Bad word of mouth will destroy you.
Yeah. Exactly. We're all tend to gravitate towards bad news a little more than the good one, also at the beginning of your book, you shared your journey with Winston-Salem State University, and you try to make it to be the first choice for Black students in North Carolina. But you mentioned that it required a cultural shift. How do you rally people around campus around that goal, and what role did empathy-driven marketing play for you at WSSU?
Yeah, I can't take full credit for rallying folks around that. Chancellor Elwood Robinson played a huge part in that, and he is a very empathy-led leader. So we were a really good matchup in this effort. But we really needed to help the campus overcome this sort of, I don't mean this the way it sounds, but I can't think of a better way to phrase this. This inferiority complex. Like, we were just down the road from NCA&T, which was the second largest HBCU in the country, and got all this attention and accolades, but we had actually better outcomes than they did. But we weren't telling that story when I got there. And what we really wanted the campus community to understand is that we're making major differences in students' lives, and we want them to know, and they deserve to feel like they're at an institution that's exceptional. And so getting people to feel pride again in their institution was really, really important. So it wasn't just about conveying to students how great we were. It was about making sure every single human being that worked on campus also understood that and walked around with a little puffed up chest of we have the best outcomes in the state in a whole bunch of categories. And we were the second best HBCU in the country for graduation rates, second only to Spelman. We should be walking around, pounding our chests going, look how great we are, and helping the campus community have that pride, and then helping them to understand that every single person on the campus was part of that brand. That the interactions that people have with housekeepers, the interactions that people have with the folks in financial aid, in the parking office, all of those were important touch points. And so if we were saying that we cared about students and we were a community, and that in the truest sense of the word, we have each other's backs, even the letters telling people they were late paying their bills had to be written with that voice.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, some folks were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe Jamie Hunt and her team have to read every single thing that we send to a student, and they're annoyed. But then, you know, I think when we started to show the results and started to show how proud students suddenly were of going to WSSU and seeing them just bragging about going there on social media like they'd never had before, that got people really excited and on board with it.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for tuning into the show today. I hope you enjoyed so far. Have you ever thought about starting your own podcast, but were just overwhelmed by the sheer amount of work that goes into it? I get it. After producing over 100 episodes for the Education Marketing Leader, there's a lot of time that goes into this, time that most of us simply don't have. And that's where the Education Marketing Leader podcast production service comes into play. Me and my team will take care of the heavy lifting, from scripting, strategy, editing, to promoting. All you have to do is show up, record your episode, share your expertise, connect with your audience, and build your personal brand. So if you've been sitting on a podcast idea, today is the time to act. Reach out to me via DM on LinkedIn, and we'll get you started. And now, back to the episode. That's awesome. Yeah, I love the branding part you had in the beginning of the book as well. You know, it's not the logo or the colors. It's how people talk about you when you're not in the room, how people feel about your brand. And the one thing that I thought was kind of funny too, I think it was the president in your first week came into your office and pointed at the logo and told you, how are we going to fix this?
Yes.
Was that something that was brought up in your interview, or was that out of left field when he came to you that day?
It was a little bit out of left field. He is a psychologist. And so my interview with him was very much like almost like a psychology appointment. Like it was very different. And so for him to have said that was like, oh, well, I guess I know what my first big task is going to be. And he was very fortunately, because I hear from colleagues that this is not the case everywhere, he was fully understanding that it wasn't just about the logo, that we needed to do a lot of other things too. But that logo and changing an athletic logo and changing an athletic logo at an HBCU, that is a, I'm going to add, and changing an athletic logo at an HBCU when you're white, that is a daunting, daunting task. So we had to do that very, very carefully. But I'm really, really grateful that he got that it wasn't just about the changing the logo, that the logo change, we could harness that as an opportunity to build more pride in the institution, but we had to have a whole story and a narrative to back that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody look at the Google the old logo and compare it to the new one to see what Jamie's been talking about. But we're talking about brand, we're talking about how people feel. You described a powerful shift from focusing on features to focusing on feelings. Can you unpack it a little bit, what empathy during marketing looks like and how that goes beyond the storytelling, the traditional storytelling?
So have you ever laid in bed and thought, gosh, I wonder if I'll have small class sizes at school? You know, no kid is laying in bed thinking like, boy, I sure hope I get a high quality education taught by dedicated faculty in an inspiring environment. You know, those aren't the types of questions that students are having. Prospective students are thinking about, am I going to fit in? Am I going to be able to, is the work going to be at my level? Whether that's I'm high academic achiever or somebody who's going to need support, will I have the support I need? Will my faculty know my name? And so when you see advertising that's like small classes, great value, which I talk about in my book, that's a bullet point, right? Mm-hmm. We have small classes. Mm-hmm. What it doesn't do is unpack why that's important and what that means. And it answers no questions. I guarantee that no student has a rubric that says small classes is one of the things that they're checking. They want to know so much more deep and emotional things. Some students are spending literally hundreds of thousands of dollars for their education. This is not a fact-based decision. This is a fact plus emotion. And emotion and emotional drivers are probably the most important thing that we can trigger to help people make that decision and choose us.
Yeah. The three common questions is, the first two is, can I afford it, right? The second question is, do I have my major? But then the most important one, especially for the ones coming out of high school, do I fit in?
Mm-hmm.
Is this my tribe?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something definitely valuable there as well, to showcase the day in the life, the the student testimonials and just even, I don't know, I've never worked at a university, but maybe even connecting with a student ambassador before they ever come on campus, right?
Yeah, I would love to see more schools do, I'm giving this idea away for free, reverse college tours where alumni are giving the tours. Ooh. And they're talking about what their experience was or what stuff has changed, because usually things change for the better, right? And you would want to coach your alumni to lead with that. But, you know, making it so that there's this, the students not just connected to current students, but that they can see themselves as part of a legacy that goes back to the founding of the institution. And I talk about that in the book, how important it can be, particularly at, I would say, those really niche type of colleges like women's colleges, HBCUs, tribal colleges, to make that connection back to the founding and the audacious vision that the founder had to build this school for a population that was traditionally excluded from college. But, you know, having these opportunities to tell a story that's bigger than just what's offered today, I think is important.
I love the little snippet you put in there. I think it was the founder of Winston-Salem State University when he, you know, in late 1800s when he started the university, and they asked him, what are you going to teach your students? And he's like, what do they teach at Harvard? Right? Super powerful.
Yeah.
little nugget there too, you know? It's like, again, don't have that inferiority complex. Regardless of your position, whether you work at a community college, whether you work at an R1 institution, right? It doesn't really matter, because like you also said, I think you said, you quoted Seth Godin in the book, but it was about the drill bit story. But Seth Godin also says, if you market to everyone, you market to no one.
Mm-hmm.
And my belief is that if you are a small rural college, you have your set audience that only would fit in with you. Like we talked about at the beginning of the episode, right? If you have somebody apply to your school and they would not be a good fit, they'll churn. Mm-hmm. So don't leave with the assumption that if you work for a small university or college in Arkansas, that everybody in your state wants to be a Razorback. That just is not the case.
Yeah.
You know, so we gotta. You know, this goes into that human emotion as well. Just look beyond the flashy, shiny billboards and understand that every human thinks differently.
Yeah. And I think there's a place truly for everyone that wants to go to college. There's an institution that fits them best. You know, my niece is a college student right now, going to a really, really big school. She's going to my alma mater. I didn't recommend that. I thought she would have done better at a smaller school. But you know, like me, she was sort of like, this is where you're going to go. It's cause it's, you know, affordable. It's the affordable public in the state. But not everybody's going to thrive at a big school. Not everybody's going to thrive at a small school. Not everybody's going to thrive in a religious school. Not everybody's going to thrive in a secular school. Mm-hmm. You know, it's finding those students that will thrive where you are, but you have to make sure that the story that you're telling is abundantly clear what thriving at your institution looks like and means.
Right. Exactly. One of my favorite lines, again, in the book, there's a lot of favorite lines there.
Oh,
truly,
you.
If you read that book, it's one of those things that you don't want to put down. Funny story, I was reading it on the Kindle in my bedroom the other night, and it was like 10 o'clock, and I just kept reading it, preparing for this interview. And my wife said, can you turn off the light? I said, sure. So I keep reading, though. The little light comes off the Kindle, right? And I keep reading and reading. She says, what are you doing? I say, oh, I'm reading. Like 30 minutes later, she's like, can you read somewhere else? Can you get out of the room and read somewhere else? Because it was one of those things you pick it up and you can't put it down. It's such a good book. So again, I highly recommend everybody to read this book as we finish this episode. And then I'm going to link to the show notes, obviously. Just go ahead and get it. Highly recommend it. But so we talked about how students want to feel seen and understood in a sea of impersonal brochures and generic emails. You mentioned it as well. And you talked about segmentation. How can institutions break out of the pattern of crafting these generic emails just to have another item and just push everything out to everyone? And then all of a sudden that particular student gets three different email from three different departments. How do you break out of that pattern?
Yeah. I mean, busting silos, anybody who's ever heard me speak about anything knows that's my passion. But making, I think one of the big problems that we have is that once a student is admitted, basically, like on a lot of campuses, every office is now emailing them and they're getting this sort of chaotic, like, deadlines and what am I supposed to do here? And they don't have a central hub for everything that they need to accomplish. And so I think, you know, busting those silos and working together and thinking of yourself as one institution is really, really important. Mm-hmm. And I think, and this goes well beyond recruitment. I have a chapter on recruitment, but I also have a chapter on retention. So often, the marketing team is entirely focused on getting the student in the door. Mm-hmm. And then all the comms that happen after that are offices scattered all over. It's an administrative assistant there. It's a department chair here. And none of them are necessarily trained in marketing and communications. Mm-hmm. And so you get this sort of transactional, not super well written stuff that's going out to students. And they went from, it's almost like a bait and switch, super polished and like cozy and warm, and we're bringing you in the door. And then you're here and we're like, yeah, you're not important anymore. What kind of message is that?
Not good.
Not good.
Yeah. Yeah. I hate that bait and switch. It's again anywhere, right? If somebody's listening, it's not in higher education. It's the same thing for B2B marketers as well, because I have some people listening into the show from that, getting all cozy with people that bring them in the door, and then all of a sudden they're not getting what they were promised. And it's where churn happens. Earlier you mentioned that everybody's saying the same, but if everybody's saying the same thing, nobody's saying really anything. Now let's go back to that a little bit more, because we're talking about communications and the relevancy of that with prospective students in different stages of life. What advice would you give a marketer who is stuck in this safe zone with taglines of small classes, big value?
Yeah. So one of the things that I, as I was writing the book, that I thought was, I need to have exercises in this book to help people break out of their current approach. So the book has there's a whole chapter in the front section, which is about marketing with empathy, and a whole chapter in the back section about leading with empathy, that's full of exercises that you can do, whether that's empathy mapping, looking at like the timing of your comms. There's just a ton of exercise in it. I think that's a really great place to start. And I also think if you're looking at where can I stand out in the marketplace, taking a look at your true competitors, like don't look at Harvard, right? Where nobody's competing with Harvard. Like there's very few people listening to this that are competing with Harvard. But look at your true competitors, and you're looking for where are they not making emotional resonant messaging? So where are they just being very fact-based? What are they not saying? And how can you fit into that spot with messages that are deeper and more emotionally resonant, more authentic, so that you can stand out compared to that competitor in that space. There are 4,000 schools in this country. I would love to have my book in the hands of everybody at all 4,000 of those schools. That's not going to be the case. So you, the listener who reads the book and does the exercises and does these things, your competitor might not be. So you have an opportunity to, you know, stand out and grab a little bit more market share, I think.
Yes. Well, but we'll do our best at the Education Marketing Leader podcast to get as many books in the hands of marketers of those 4,000 institutions here in the United States and abroad, because I have listeners coming all the way from Saudi Arabia as well.
So that's awesome.
Should be great. As we bring this episode to a close, let's get into chapter 3 real quick. It dives into recruitment and you know, you wrote there, instead of asking what do we need to tell them, ask what do they need right now. We talked about that earlier a little bit, right? Crafting messages in August that are irrelevant. So how can marketers shift from an institutional lens to a student first mindset in recruitment strategies?
Yeah. So this is one thing I think we do occasionally, but it's hard, so we don't do it enough. Yeah. And that's listen. So I was working with a client on a communications plan, and we did a lot of focus groups with students to be able to understand what were their emotions at various points in their journey, right? Mm-hmm. And to understand, when did you start getting stressed about the finance piece? When did you start getting stressed about this? When, what were you thinking at different phases of the cycle? Because it's not just about getting the app. It's about getting that deposit. It's about getting them to orientation. It's about getting them to show up. It's about getting them to come back. And so actually sitting down and talking with students about what that calendar looks like for them. Mm-hmm. When were they most in need of what message? Because I heard from a few people like, I was stressed about financial aid and y'all were pushing messages about orientation. Mm-hmm. I was stressed about going to orientation, but I wasn't getting anything about what was going to happen at orientation. You know, so listen. That's like the number one thing. And, you know, we talked about at the very beginning, the idea of standing and looking at the rainstorm versus being in the rain. To do that, you have to spend time with the audience. Mm-hmm. You have to spend time with the stakeholders in order to really know what that rain feels like on your skin, mm-hmm. and to know when those moments are and how you can meet them.
I remember, because I went to school paying out of pocket part-time as an adult, and I was always stressed about the due date. When is the last day I can drop this class, Craig? Yes. Because I went in there, it's like, I have 5 days to check it out. But then once I'm on the hook and I have to pay for it.
Yes, thing. I remember so that always, too.
Yeah, exactly. Final question here. You write in the book, chapter 3, the best message isn't the one that gets read. The best message is the one that gets acted on.
Yes.
How can higher ed marketing teams craft messages that not only inform, but also inspire action? And how does empathy make that possible?
Yeah. I mean, one, everything probably needs to be shorter than it is. Two, don't put 5 actions into one message, right? Mm-hmm. That's overwhelming for people. Three, make it super easy to understand how to take that action. My savings account, my bank split off. So I have a different bank for my savings account. That's been the case since September. I still haven't figured out how to log in. There's too many steps and it's not clear. So I just look at the statements like, well, the money's still in there, but I don't log in. You know, make it super, super easy, and then make a case for why it benefits them to take that action. People are selfish, right? We care about what matters to us. Yep. So make a case in the messaging about why they should take that action, and then they're much more likely to actually do it. Mm. So it's simpler than I just made it sound with all of these steps, but shorter, easier to understand, and make a case for why you need to take that action is basically the fundamentals. And then from an empathy perspective, it truly is empathetic to make things more clear. It is empathetic to make a case for why somebody benefits, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Empathy is not just about being nice. I had somebody who interviewed me for an article who was like, okay, but how do we balance being nice with like getting messages out? And I was like, that's empathy isn't just being nice. It's seeing it from the user's viewpoint and giving them what they need so mm-hmm. they can make the decision that takes the action you need them to make.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And when it comes to simplicity, use that. I heard that KISS method, right? Keep it simple, you know. So where can people get the book and how can they get in touch with you to continue this conversation, Jamie?
Yeah, so that you can get the book. It's available pretty much everywhere. I have links to a lot of places on the website, heartoverhypebook.com. And it's available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, bookshop.org, lots of little indie places, and it's available in ebook and paperback.
Very good. And be sure to pitch this book at the Education Marketing Leader Book Club as well, and I'm sure we're going to pick it up soon. Read it as a joint group and get you on that first spot of the rankings for marketing books here soon. Jamie, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to chat, and I hope we see each other in person soon.
We will. Take care, my friend.
Bye.
And that's a wrap for this episode, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to Education Marketing Leader Podcast this week. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to share it with your friends and your network. And if you ever thought about starting your own podcast, now that you listen to one and you got inspired, reach out to me via DM. We'd love to help you launch your own. We'll take care of everything for you, the scripting, the strategy, the editing, the distribution. All you have to do is show up, connect with your audience, and build your personal brand. So if you're ready for it, let's chat. And for everybody else, we'll see you next time at the Education Marketing Leader Podcast. Take care, friends.